Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to Mary Ann DeSens, who has passed to her spirit, and all the Rosie the Riveters who, during World War II, made our country strong.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
And good morning out there, America. Bob Gould here for Veterans Radio and bringing you another program live. That's right, we do all our programs live. That's the only way to do things. You get all that little spontaneity. We've been on the air for over 10 years. My partner Dale is having a little break right now, and I want to say hello to Dale. And by the way, he's probably going to come and strafe my house, but he's going to have a little medical on Tuesday. And you know what? Y'all can give him a heads up. Good luck. That's at Dale@veteransradio.net. Dale@veteransradio.net. I'm sure he'd like to hear that. Give him a little hello and a good luck in Tuesday's procedure. And, of course, we're all going to welcome him back next week. He is due back. He better be back and get off sick call. With me right now, running the board with a big smile, always makes everybody happy, Nina.
Good morning, Bob. Good morning, world. Glad to be here today.
And how else can our listeners pick up Veterans Radio? What else do we have out there? Going to give all those all that information.
Well, if anybody would like to follow us or interact when it's not 9 a.m. on a Saturday, you can find us at facebook.com/veteransradio. The same goes for Twitter, twitter.com/veteransradio.
Well, thank you very much. And I don't do any of that stuff. I guess I'm going to have to. I know. I'm getting better.
Bob, we're analog people.
Yeah. Ooh. I don't know. I've been following that analog. I know what all that is. But anyway, we're right here at Veterans Radio. With me today is a frequent guest of ours. I really want to welcome John McManus. Not yet. Because we're going to get this very important. But before I have this very important message, I want to start with this. Beware of the military-industrial complex, said by Eisenhower. What's that all about? Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very important message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
From the shores of China, I know that's all about the Marines, but I just love that opening, and I thought that was so appropriate. As I'm looking here, our three generals that we're going to be talking about today, this idea for a program started about 3 months ago with my guest today, and I'm so proud of being able to do this particular program because I got a lot of questions and things that might be rumors or tales. Well, we're going to get all that straightened around. That's right here on Veterans Radio, because if you want to know everything about veterans, and that's what we support veterans, all those that have served and all of those that do support veterans, we salute all of you. By the way, if you have a question for our guest, don't hesitate. Call us on the air. Well, we don't have to put you on the air, but if you want to come on the air and ask a question, y'all can do that. 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. Now, getting right now to the generals. My guest today is author John C. McManus. He's a professor of military history at Missouri University of Science and Technology. Professor McManus, he's written numerous books on World War II. We're going to be talking right at the end of this program. You got a scoop coming up here, folks. There's a new book coming out. It's going to be absolutely, well, I'm not going to tell you all about that. You're going to have to wait for the whole program to hear that. But he also, Professor McManus, serves as a member of the editorial board at World War II magazine. Professor McManus, John, my friend, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Bob, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on. I want to give my best wishes to Dale on Tuesday.
And I know Missouri is the show-me state. So we're going to be showing everybody today. And we're going to be talking, I love this quote. I'm going to start with this, beware the military-industrial complex by Eisenhower. John, what did that mean?
Yeah, that was from Eisenhower's final speech. After when he was about to leave the presidency in 1960-61. And, you know, what he meant was that the defense establishment might become sort of kind of self-justifying, that this would lead to massive expenditures that would bankrupt the United States during the Cold War, trying to sort of follow an arms race with the communist world. And he was leery of that. He was a budget hawk. He did not like the idea of the United States going into debt, and he thought a good way to go into debt was to spend too much on the armed forces. And he felt, since he'd spent his life in the Army, that he knew what was necessary and what was not. And he felt that the country, after he was leaving the presidency, might head down the wrong road in that direction.
So he was a pragmatist, right?
He was a relentless pragmatist, really, his entire life. And it's one of the things that made him effective. But also, from a presidential standpoint, he believed very strongly that the United States could never put more soldiers under arms in a conventional way than China and the Soviet Union and the communist world, and that if we tried to do that, we would bankrupt ourselves and we would unravel our economy, which was what was most important about the United States. And he felt also that all expenditures for military stuff inevitably would come at the expense of other things, schools and hospitals and food and health care and so on and so forth, and he just didn't feel that was right.
Well, that made him the obvious choice for the largest, biggest land-sea effort to land forces, invade Europe. Is that true? But before I get – what kind of infantry training did he have prior to that?
Eisenhower wasn't an infantry branch officer, so he'd had quite a bit of infantry training from his earliest days at West Point onward throughout his entire career. He just never had the opportunity to command infantry soldiers at the at the platoon, company, battalion, regimental level. This was a profound disappointment to him. He was always an extremely effective member of someone else's staff. In fact, he ran one of the key military training camps during World War One. He was, fresh out of West Point at that stage, didn't get deployed over to France, and he thought that would be the end of his career because he hadn't commanded troops in France. And he really went through some tough times in the interwar period, wondering whether to stay in the Army or not, whether he had a career ahead of him. But, he was a career infantryman who had a very good sense of infantry tactics, but he hadn't necessarily, what we now say, been there and done that.
Now tell us about West Point and General Eisenhower. What was his studies like? What was his academic standing, et cetera? Go ahead and tell us.
Eisenhower's academic standing was kind of middle of the road. He was, I wouldn't say a disinterested student, but he wasn't one of the better students. He was someone who delighted in flouting the draconian rules of West Point and walked many guard posts because of it. He was an excellent football player. That's one thing that I don't know that we remember all these years later about Eisenhower. He was a really good football player. He was a fast halfback who was very difficult to tackle, very elusive. And he was going to be a key part of West Point's football team. And they had good teams back then, about 100 years ago. But he hurt his knee, and this was an injury that bothered him his entire life and kind of ruined his football career. And West Point for him really represented opportunity. He came from, kind of a lower middle class, if that, background in small town America, Abilene, Kansas. He had four brothers. They were an upwardly mobile group of folks. All of his brothers did very, very well in their professions. And Eisenhower, for him, the Army was a way to have a successful life. So West Point represented that opportunity.
I've seen his home in Abilene. It was humble. It was humble. It wasn't Tobacco Road, but it was very humble. What did his father do?
His father, I think, was a was partially into farming, but more so a kind of a small businessman, handyman. He was a guy who kind of cobbled together a living. Again, hoping at each point that he would be able to sort of run his own profitable business. And while I don't think he could say that he terribly failed and was destitute or anything like that, he never really was on very good financial footing. He was a respected person in Abilene. He was a person who was thought of as a good family man, but he was not a person of means at all.
So those beautiful and wonderful Midwest values were passed on to Ike Eisenhower. Somehow I have to picture, and the ball's handed off to Ike. I never knew that. He was a halfback and a very good one at that. That was an interesting little comment. Well, he was named, here comes the invasion, Overlord. We got Eisenhower, we got Churchill, we got Stalin. They wanted to start a second front over there on the continent. Who's gonna lead all this, folks? So who decided everything and who assigned Eisenhower? Start with that.
It's President Franklin Roosevelt who makes that decision to assign Eisenhower to head up what's called Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force to command the Normandy invasion, which, of course, I think we could argue that's the most high-profile, famous command position in the entire history of the United States Armed Forces. Eisenhower had functioned in a similar role in the Mediterranean during the invasion of North Africa and the invasion of Sicily. So he had a lot of relationships with commanders from various allied nations, and Eisenhower was a very good diplomat in that sense. He was a person who had a likable, affable personality, but he was also, one of the things that had gotten him to this point, Eisenhower was just one of these people who was exceptionally competent and just knew how to get things done. And under times of stress or whatever, he was a person you leaned on, and this had been his whole career. Finally somebody noticed, and that major somebody is General George Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, who came to think of Eisenhower as a very key person for World War II and made sure to promote him over people who had a great deal of seniority over him that put him in position when World War II happened to have this kind of command. So it's Marshall's willingness to go beyond old Army seniority to pick what he thought was the best person for the job that helps lead Eisenhower to that way.
Folks, if you have a question for our guest, please call us at 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. We paid for that call, so give us a call, 877-573-7825. Well, every time I see Eisenhower, he just has that, he has a very positive affect, like, hey, I know this guy. He must be a neighbor, somebody. So that had to have a profound effect on his being selected. But also, in his eyes, there were moments in some of the photographs that I looked at, don't mess with this guy. How did all that play out with the other Allied commanders?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I think you summed up Eisenhower very well. And I'll just give you I'll start with just a little personal anecdote that I think illustrates your larger point. My maternal grandfather had a sort of a passing resemblance to Eisenhower, and even to this day, every time my mom sees a picture of Eisenhower, she says, it reminds me of my father. And I think that was true of millions of Americans, that he had this ability to really connect, that he seemed like your nice uncle, your nice grandfather, your nice father, whatever. He just had that sense also of setting you at ease, of being a person, He was very down to earth. And in terms of his personal dealings with other commanders, he was respectful. He was considerate. He was thoughtful. He had a good sense of humor. He didn't take himself too seriously, and obviously he was very bright. So he ingratiated himself with people without being sycophantic or anything along those lines. He had, as you've also indicated, steel in his spine. He was a guy in the end you didn't mess with. And this is the other side of Eisenhower that I find fascinating, is that he had a volcanic temper. I mean, he had a major temper as a kid, like as an adolescent and teenager. And he used to have horrendous temper tantrums that he had to learn to control. And so you'll see throughout his adult life that temper is often wanting to get out. And then he has this other side, the placating side, that tends to calm Dwight down. But it's always there, these two sides of Eisenhower.
Well, okay, now that really played well when he had to interact with all the Allied commanders. But how about his relationship with Monty?
With Monty, yeah, with Bernard Montgomery, who, of course, is the most famous British commander in World War II. Well, this is his most difficult relationship to manage. I think that's fair to say. And, in fact, there was a dislike on Eisenhower's part from the first time he ever met Montgomery. What happened there, Eisenhower had been sent to England in 1942, more or less to plan for an invasion of France that year, which, of course, never happens. But he goes and gets briefed in Montgomery's headquarters by Montgomery, who I think at that point was a corps commander for the British Army. And Montgomery absolutely hated smoking, could not stand cigarettes. Eisenhower was basically a chain smoker. And so Eisenhower lights up a cigarette in Montgomery's headquarters, and Montgomery, who was briefing Eisenhower and a couple other officers, stops and says, "Who is that cigarette? Put that out." And it just sort of humiliates Eisenhower in front of all these other people. And Eisenhower just really detested him from that moment forward, but knew he had to work with him. And of course, that relationship plays out, you know, over the course of the Normandy invasion and the heavy fighting that goes on over that next year. Eisenhower constantly has to deal with the politics surrounding Montgomery.
Yes, and I can recall photographs and news clippings, clips of Eisenhower and Montgomery head to head, almost bumping heads and going over strategy and that. And that sounds like, or it looks like, that might have been more of a photo op. Is that correct?
Oh, it's always a photo op. Yeah, no doubt about that. And you know, in Eisenhower's case, he has to respect this guy. What he means to the British, and the fact that, when we get down to it, Montgomery had a lot more combat and infantry and command experience than Eisenhower did. And, you know, so he's constantly sort of champing at the bit to shove Eisenhower aside and turn him into a kind of a titular head sort of thing, a figurehead. And Eisenhower has to keep putting him in his place. And so that's part of the push-pull of the relationship. But part of what's going on there, too, which is more interesting from a kind of a big-picture level and understanding what's about to happen, is that, you know, Britain's power is declining by the end of the war. And Montgomery is really struggling with that. And Eisenhower represents this massive new superpower of the United States, which already is calling the shots by the end of World War II and soon will during the Cold War. And so that's a big part of what's playing out in their relationship.
Well, here we go. The Germans now are on retreat. They're getting their Borscht kicked and pushed back. So here come the Russians. They're talking about now. There was Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt. I believe it was Potsdam when they talked about the reapportionment of Germany. And did Eisenhower trust the Russians?
Eisenhower did not necessarily trust the Russians. He hoped, just as Roosevelt did, that in the post-war period, these two new superpowers, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, would be able to work together effectively and that the alliance would not fall apart. But Eisenhower really had no illusions about the Russians and what their system represented. And though he didn't necessarily know the ins and outs of how Joseph Stalin worked, Eisenhower was a very, again, pragmatic operator who took everyone at real value, I think, whether that was his friends, such as Winston Churchill, or his what turns out to be his adversaries, the Soviets. Now, he had Eisenhower at the end of World War II hoped to establish a strong rapport with Georgi Zhukov, who's sort of the Russian equivalent of Eisenhower, and certainly the best Soviet commander of the war, a brilliant commander in his own way, but incredibly ruthless in a Stalin-Bolshevik sort of way. And they did have a good personal rapport, but they could never truly understand each other. And I also think that's kind of a microcosm for what's about to happen with the Cold War. Now, they, as far as dividing up Germany, they began that at the Yalta Conference in February of 45. And, of course, Potsdam happens, you know, in July of 45 and continues the process even further.
Now, here are the Allies pushing east, but they stopped. They didn't go into Berlin. And they, when I look at the final line of the Allies' progress going east, and I take a look at that, we let the Russians come into Berlin. How much of an influence? I'm sure Marshall had something. I'm sure Churchill and Roosevelt had something to do with that. But how much influence did Eisenhower have as to? I mean, was he saying, "Let's go to Berlin and take"?
No, Eisenhower's influence is supreme. In the same way that, you know, an umpire's call at second base is the final word. Eisenhower has the power to make that call as to whether the Western armies are going to go to Berlin. Now, he's got other people trying to influence that decision, Winston Churchill being the most prominent among them. And at that point, of course, Roosevelt had died, and Truman is new to the job. He's really not much of a factor in this regard. It's primarily Churchill who's sort of lobbying to go to Berlin. But, you know, we must point out, if Churchill wants to go to Berlin and take Berlin, he kind of wants to do this with American manpower. And you're talking about an urban battle that's going to cost many, many thousands of lives. The Soviets suffered well into six figures in terms of casualties. This is a major battle. And Eisenhower realizes this, and he understands that Berlin is going to be jointly occupied anyway. So you're going to have to give up much of what you take, and Berlin is also going to be located deep within the Soviet zone of occupation. So Eisenhower makes that call, and he's heavily criticized for it, especially during the early years of the Cold War, to not go to Berlin and to basically, you know, just stand aside and stop at the Elbe River and let the Soviets go and take Berlin. My personal opinion, I think that was a very smart move.
Well, folks, think of that. Think of that. Had that had happened, instead of the Russians, it were the Americans, a million casualties. A million casualties, and there we were. We wanted to avoid that at Japan, so we dropped the atomic bomb. But here is, in Germany, that never happened, folks. And I think that was I think that was so significant when we first talked about that, John. But there was something else. There were desertions. There were soldiers that were going, "Hey, I don't want to be the last one shot." And there was a particular soldier, Private Eddie Slovak. He happened to be from Detroit, Michigan, and having the final word on whether this person would be spared or not would be Eisenhower. Tell us about that and the black market. Tell us about that, John.
Almost definitely. Eisenhower had to deal with significant problems with desertions, with people getting evacuated from the front line because of trench foot, sickness, combat fatigue, a lot of different possibilities. And those issues tend to conflate. You know, what's a deserter and what's someone with combat fatigue, you know, in the context of this massive war? He's got that problem to deal with. He's got black marketeering. Some of those deserters have gravitated to urban areas in Paris or in France, Paris being most notable among them, and have basically set up as an underworld. And they are hijacking supply columns in order to either sustain themselves or to sell a lot of the stuff on the black market. This is not just Americans, but also British. All this stuff is going on. He's having to deal with it. He's kind of bleeding manpower. This is one of the misnomers about the campaign in Europe is the idea that the Allies just have all this manpower, especially the Americans, and they're inevitably going to roll over the Germans. Well, certainly they have an advantage, but if you look at the combat units, they were not in very good shape for manpower by the fall of 44. So Eisenhower wants to send a message that desertion is not acceptable, and there's no question. He makes an example of Private Slovak, who is the only American deserter who was executed for that crime during World War II.
By the way, folks, his cemetery, his plot is at Woodmere Cemetery in Detroit, Michigan. All you folks that are within, let's say, 50 to 60, 70, 100 miles of Detroit, you can go to Woodmere Cemetery on 4th Street and actually see that grave. There we go. John, we're going to be right back right after this message. Please stay with us, and we're going to be talking about, oh, man, what an ego, MacArthur, after this very important message. Nina?
You're listening to Veterans Radio live from our flagship station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, or listen to us online at AveMariaRadio.net.
Ian Ralston was a combat medic who was injured in Iraq. When I met Ian, I knew he had to help him get his housing grant, benefit to live as normal a life as possible. My name is Jason Stevenson, and I work for Paralyzed Veterans of America.
PVA has helped hundreds of thousands of veterans get the care and benefits they've earned, changing lives, building futures. To learn more, visit PVA.org, a public service of Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Back on Veterans Radio, Bob Gould right here on Veterans Radio bringing you today with my host, guest John C. McManus. We're talking about the generals. I look at the flyer. When I put those three photos together, I had a chance to crop them or make them fit with, but I left MacArthur's a little bit wider on purpose, folks, because he was a little bit I guess he saw himself as sort of grander than grand, and there was this very telling. There was this film clips, and I'm sure we've all seen them or photos or what. He's coming back to the Philippines now. Here's the boat, the Higgins boat that dropped the ramp. Now, it could have dropped the ramp right on the shore. No. It was 10 to 20 feet. He had to wade through the water along with all of his people. Now, I wonder if that was shot, because I heard that was shot more than one time. So what did he have to do? Did he have to change his pants each time, his shoes, what? Well, tell us about that eagle, John.
You know, I like to say that where MacArthur is concerned, on a good day, his ego might fit in the Grand Canyon, and only maybe. I mean, MacArthur was all about ego, and he's one of these people who makes up for his own insecurities by being even more egotistical. MacArthur certainly was a person of significant intellect, intelligence, capability, competence. He was a born soldier, there's no question. But he was also vainglorious, and this is one of the real weaknesses that he will have, is doing things to feed his own ego and kind of create this sort of MacArthur cult, this image that is constantly splayed upon the American people to build him up, almost like as a cult of personality. MacArthur was the closest thing we would have to a military aristocrat, the son of a prominent general, who was almost like destined to be a general in that sense.
And, well, what about the Medal of Honor?
Yeah, the Medal of Honor, he is one of only, I believe, two family members, people in the same family who have received the Medal of Honor. His father had received it for bravery in the Civil War, obviously, on the Union side. His father was Arthur MacArthur, and he became a lieutenant general in command of U.S. military forces in the Philippine-American War in the early 20th century. Douglas was West Point class of 1903, who, of course, obviously is in a major command position in the Pacific in World War II, but specifically at the beginning of the war, he commanded American and Filipino forces, which were ill-fated, and Roosevelt had ordered him out of the Philippines rather than see him captured by the Japanese once the garrison collapses. So he confers upon Douglas the Medal of Honor, which is really the most political Medal of Honor perhaps ever awarded, because this was not really for any extreme valor or bravery, which is often what we correctly associate with the award. Douglas's Medal of Honor is really for the morale of the American people. And by the way, the other recipients, from the same family, are the Roosevelts, Theodore and his son, Ted Roosevelt. Theodore, the president who, fought at San Juan Hill in the Spanish-American War. And then his son, who was a general in World War II, who got the Medal of Honor for great bravery at Utah Beach on D-Day.
Now, folks, this is not disparaging about MacArthur, not at all. But let's, we're getting right down to the man. And I thought about wading ashore. What do you do when you come to the shore? You ever had sand in your sneakers? Oh, boy, I could just see that. Here's a general walking around. Squeaky shoot. No. So that was a big-time photo op, but it did show him. Here he is. He's coming ashore for the Philippines. But he had to talk Nimitz, didn't he not, into the campaign, sort of shifting to the Philippines way rather than going direct to Japan. Tell us about that.
Yeah, in fact, he had to struggle with Nimitz and convince FDR, because what had happened is FDR had basically divided the vast Pacific theater into these two rival commanders. Nimitz, of course, Chester Nimitz, who was a Navy admiral, commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet, he's going to get what's often called the Central Pacific Prong, whose ultimate purpose is to get to Tokyo. And MacArthur commanded the Southwest Pacific, which is a lot of fighting and, portions of the Solomons, much of New Guinea. But MacArthur's ultimate aim is to get back to the Philippines, which he loved and, of course, had been thrown out of in 1942. But he loved the Filipino people, and he felt the United States had a commitment to come back and liberate them from the Japanese yoke, and he felt that this would be conducive to America's long-term interest because he felt Asia and the Pacific, this is where MacArthur, you could argue, might have been right, that Asia and the Pacific was the place of greatest American economics and influence in the long, long run. And it may have worked out that way, looking back seven decades later, more so than Europe. So he was an implacable opponent of the Europe First policy during World War II. But by the summer 1944, this return to the Philippines is no sure thing. And he meets with Nimitz and FDR at Pearl Harbor. And it gives this long presentation in which he persuades FDR to go ahead with this invasion of the Philippines in 1944 and 45.
What was MacArthur's – how did he feel about Eisenhower?
Oh, well, Eisenhower had worked for MacArthur for many years as really his key staff person. And MacArthur had been – he had an interesting Army career in that – and he served as a young officer in the Philippines. Then he is in a prominent position within the 42nd Infantry Division, the Rainbow Division, during World War I as a chief of staff and as a brigade commander. He had been superintendent of West Point, and then eventually he becomes U.S. Army chief of staff, the top position, by the early 1930s. And Eisenhower was a young major and then lieutenant colonel on his staff and someone MacArthur heavily, heavily relied upon. And then Eisenhower will work for MacArthur once he retires and goes to the Philippines to basically function as a generalissimo in charge of creating a Filipino army. And Eisenhower became so disgusted with MacArthur and how he operated and his egotism and all the rest of this that he wangled a different assignment and left by 1939. Otherwise, Eisenhower might have been captured when the Japanese invaded in 1941 and 1942. So MacArthur, in turn, if you caught him in an honest moment, would tell you that Eisenhower was a fine man of exceptional competence and reliability. But usually there are layers of ego involved, so he would find ways to put down Eisenhower. And the favorite story I like to tell that I think illustrates this happened when Eisenhower was elected president in 1952, which, by the way, MacArthur had badly wanted to become president. That's part of what was driving him during and after World War II. And, of course, this hadn't happened. So MacArthur's wife asked him the night of Ike's election, what kind of president do you think he'll make? And MacArthur kind of paused in his own dramatic way and said, well, I think a very good one. He was the best clerk I ever had.
Well, on that note, Nina, what do we have?
We have a gentleman by the name of Nick who has a question regarding Eisenhower.
Okay, Nick, you're on Veterans Radio.
Yes, hi. Actually, I had several questions or comments. Eisenhower attended West Point and he graduated in 1915. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So they have a graduating yearbook. And, well, I guess that's not terribly important, but somebody made a rather disparaging remark about him. Okay, in 1932, do you recall a joint special ops that Patton, Eisenhower, and MacArthur conjoined? That was July of 32.
Is that your question?
Yes, I was wondering. That's one of my questions.
Okay.
Are you familiar with that event?
All right. John, is that something that you can comment on?
Well, I think, are you referring to the bonus marchers? Which, what that was, during the throes of the Depression, you had a lot of military veterans who were owed benefits for their service, and one was a bonus, and certainly during these hard economic times that would have come in very handy, and they will basically converge on Washington to protest the Hoover administration to put pressure on them to pay the bonuses and to take care of the military veterans during these tough times, and some of them are going to camp out in the Anacostia Flats in Washington, D.C., or take to the streets, and MacArthur favored basically going in and breaking all this up. Eisenhower counseled strongly against that, but MacArthur will plan this operation and against Hoover's orders, and in tandem with Patton, who was also involved in this too, in the planning, basically break up these protests. MacArthur was convinced that they were communist-inspired and communist-led.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that call. You can all out there, 877-573-7825. We welcome all your comments and phone. Let's get back, though, to MacArthur. I personally know him. You got to have some egos, folks. I mean, we take a look at a lot of CEOs of big corporations and that. So there is a admiration that I have for MacArthur, and especially what I think to be brilliant was the landing at Incheon, pretty much saving the American Army there in North Korea, but in Korea, the Incheon landing. I thought it was brilliant. What about that, John?
Yeah, the Incheon landing is probably MacArthur's finest moment in terms of military operations. It's an outflanking amphibious invasion at Incheon, which is fairly close to Seoul, the South Korean capital, which the communists had taken during the initial invasion in the summer of 1950. And they had the U.N. forces penned into what's called the Pusan Perimeter in southeast Korea. So instead of just fighting your way outside of the perimeter and pushing them back up the peninsula, MacArthur will aid that by sending the 1st Marine Division in to invade Incheon well behind the North Korean lines, and then he'll follow that up with the Army 7th Infantry Division and 3rd Infantry Division. And this, of course, works magnificently. So this plays into one of his strengths, is that he has an ability to really conduct amphibious warfare quite capably and quite on the cutting edge in terms of appearing where the enemy least would expect him or want him to appear. And you already saw this tendency in New Guinea during World War II, especially the Hollandia operation. And then you see it with Incheon. The problem in many cases is what will follow, and certainly what will follow Incheon is near disaster.
Okay, we have another Nina. Do we have somebody? What line do we have that? Our screener's board is not functioning.
On line two, Mr. Bob, we have a lady by the name of Anne who would like to ask a question about MacArthur.
Here we go, and welcome to Veterans Radio. You have a question. Go ahead.
Thank you. I have a question about Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor. It seemed to me that the attack on the Philippines happened, 12 hours later, and that all those planes left out on the field vulnerable to attack could have been protected by MacArthur with advance warning. What happened there?
Well, you are exactly right. You said it perfectly. The attack in the Philippines happens within about 12 to 18 hours of the attack on Pearl Harbor. MacArthur and his command in the Philippines knew well that we were now at war with Japan. They knew about Pearl Harbor, and they were actually his air commanders are planning a raid on Formosa, on Japanese airfields in Formosa. But there's a sort of paralysis in the upper command structure of MacArthur's headquarters, and there will be this inertia in which the raid will not be launched, and nor will combat air patrols be put above primarily Clark Field, which is where a lot of his air assets were stationed at this point. And the bottom line of this whole thing is that much of the American Air Force is going to be caught on the ground, and about half of those planes destroyed, which leads the way to a successful Japanese invasion of Luzon and other portions of the Philippines. It's a disaster of the first order, but MacArthur is a very smooth guy in terms of blaming others or sidestepping it or making sure that there isn't coverage, media coverage of this kind of thing.
So
many or most of the American people at the time don't really even know what has happened. But it's a monumental screw-up.
So it sounds like he had his epaulets down right on that one. Well, thank you very much for that call. We have another call. Nina? No. Line one? No, we don't. Oh, there we go. Okay. Well, John. Oh, yeah. Getting back. By the way, folks, 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. We welcome those calls. Keep them coming. And Nina's got an, oh, boy, this is a hot topic today. Back to MacArthur. All right. Now, he was let go by Truman. He was ready to go all the way. Well, why don't you tell us about that? What happened?
Yeah, what happens in the aftermath of the Incheon invasion is that MacArthur and Truman decide to cross the 38th parallel and basically destroy the communist regime in North Korea. But, of course, we all know you have Mao's communist China just on the other side of the Yalu River, and there's a question of whether they're going to get in the war or react to this in some way. MacArthur, and this is another monumental miscalculation, when asked by Truman if the Chinese will get in the war, MacArthur definitively says no. I don't think they will. They've just consolidated from their civil war. I don't think they're going to want to mess with us. And he will try and deny this later, but this is at a meeting at Wake Island and with about 8, 9, 10 different people recording the proceeds proceedings of the meeting. So it's pretty clear what he advised, and he was dead wrong. And so what happens is the fall unfolds. American troops, U.N. troops as a whole, South Koreans too, are getting closer and closer to the Yalu River, and they're running into Chinese formations and fighting them. And MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo, and he was almost always very distant from his battles. He was not a lead from the front kind of guy. They're getting reports from on the ground, and they're dismissing them from the distance of Tokyo. And what ends up happening, of course, is that the Chinese were sending in massive forces, and they almost completely destroy. They could come close to destroying the entire UN army in North Korea. It's not quite a miracle that most of them get out of there, but sort of against the odds. And that's part, the famous Frozen Chosen campaign for the Marine Corps and the Army, by the way, is just one part of that.
Well, we really hit a hot topic today, folks. There's another call. Nina, what do we have?
We have a gentleman by the name of Jim with an interesting comment.
Welcome to Veterans Radio, Ken.
Hey, Bob.
Yes.
This is Jim Fosson from Legal Help for Veterans.
Oh, Jim. Good.
How are you? I wanted to see if your guest, John, has read the book General Eisenhower wrote in 1948 called Crusade in Europe.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah.
I just want to comment on that quickly, Bob. It is written in 1948, just after the war and before he's thinking, before he's president, and it's the most candid book I've ever written by a military commander. This is back in the day before 24-hour news cycles and internet, and so he's really pretty candid about how he views some of the other leaders in World War II, and it's a great read. It's still available from Amazon. You can pick it up used pretty cheap and through your website. So maybe John might comment about his view of on the Crusade in Europe.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, Crusade in Europe is a fine memoir. And Eisenhower has this real talent of providing some level of an honest assessment of people. And you got to remember, this is, you know, again, he publishes, like Jim said, in 1948. So that's pretty fresh, right after events and while everybody's still alive and while he's still in play, Eisenhower, I mean, for the presidency, you know. So he's candid without being acid and without tearing people down. And this is, I think it sheds light on one of Eisenhower's many talents, is that he was a fine writer. He was an excellent writer, and it's one of the things that had helped his career, certainly, but also had hurt it in the sense that his commanders were constantly asking him to ghostwrite important documents for them. And so Eisenhower is kind of toiling in obscurity throughout much of his life. Well, here's a general, a very prominent one, who in the aftermath of World War II doesn't need a ghostwriter like many others will, or a co-author or something like that. He can write that book himself. And it's a fine work just as far as being an interesting read on its own merits, but it's also valuable historically, too, and it's fairly accurate. Now, he dodges some aspects of the experience, as you would expect him to. An example would be Market Garden, which he goes into not in great detail, and this is the airborne invasion of Holland that he authorized in the fall of 44 that just came into disaster. So he sidesteps a few things, but by and large, it's a nice document.
Well, we want to thank Jim Falzone, who's president of LegalHelpForVeterans.com. LegalHelpForVeterans.com. If you got something, you got a question on your disability, what you want, or you want some help, you want to go to LegalHelpForVeterans.com. John. Wow, time is going by so fast, and I just love it. By the way, folks, if you do have a call, 877-573-7825, keep those calls coming. But right now, the third in our triad of generals, and I love this. I love this scene. I have seen it in still photographs. I've seen it in film clips. Omar Bradley, General Omar Bradley, they called him the dog face, of course not to his face, but he was the quintessential guy in the foxhole journal, and there he is in the Jeep. He's riding shotgun, and I'm sure there was another general there was in the back there, and it was open, and there was somebody driving, and there was a private, stopped him. This was during Ardennes. They had Germans that were dressed as Americans. They were, now you know what? Bradley was a recognizable. A German would have, with those blue eyes and blonde hair, would have had significant facial surgery to look like Bradley. But Bradley still gave up, and I looked at his face, and I studied that care, gave up his ID, and he looked stern, but he, you know, they didn't. Well, this kid was doing his job. Tell us about that moment.
Right. The soldier is doing his job, and Bradley respects that. And the job is to make sure that everybody who gets past that checkpoint is truly an American. And it doesn't matter if the person has 3 stars on his helmet or is another private. There's a lot of paranoia during the Battle of the Bulge because, as you know, the Germans had sent special units in behind or around American lines of German soldiers who spoke some English, most of them, and wore American uniforms. So they posed as U.S. soldiers and then caused problems in that respect. So it led to tremendous paranoia and to clamp down security. And there are also rumors that the Germans had sent special assassination squads to kill Allied generals like Bradley or even more notably Eisenhower, who was in Versailles. So, he's under lockdown in Versailles in Paris, Eisenhower is. And so Bradley is roaming around a little closer to the front, but having to deal with the kind of heightened operational security. So Bradley well understood that, but certainly it was a little annoying.
And I looked at his face, and boy, it was a face of consternation. But he still, and you know, when I think about, and this is not to be disparaging to MacArthur, because I definitely respect the man and his command, but I think MacArthur might have been, in my feeling, and this is my feeling, probably step on it and gone right through. So we've got Bradley doing that. Now, he was mild-mannered. He was mild-mannered, but he had a dark side. What was that, John?
The dark side of Bradley, well, it's sort of twofold. One is that he had a tendency to backbite against some of his colleagues and certainly those whom history is friendlier to, like George Patton would be, for instance. So, for instance, the movie Patton, much of that is inspired, that view of Patton, to some extent, is inspired by Bradley, who was an advisor on that film. Bradley was not a fan of Patton in many instances. You know, they had a bit of a love-hate relationship, but in the end, he resented him to some extent and didn't always like how he operated. But the other dark side is that we've all heard of the Peter principle, that when someone of fair competence gets simply promoted too high and then isn't quite as good at the higher level job, Bradley is sort of fits that mold. He was an excellent division commander. He was a very strong corps commander. As an army and an army group commander, his leadership left something to be desired in planning the Normandy invasion, in fighting in Normandy, in the Hurtgen Forest battle in the fall of 1944, the Bulge. There are many circumstances we can point to where Bradley made some pretty key errors. And so I would suppose view that as something on the other dark side. Overall, though, he was a very good man who was mild-mannered, as you said, and was a person of great competence in his own right.
Nina, we have another phone call. Let's tell us about that, Nina.
A gentleman by the name of Richard has a comment and a question for our guest today.
Richard, welcome to Veterans Radio. You're on.
Thank you very much. My father, Lawrence Daly, invented float-a-foam after the Battle of Tarawa, and allowed the landing craft to stay afloat even if the pontoons were shot. And also he invented ABS plastic, which was used to make self-sealing fuel tanks for our aircraft, which allowed the Allies to win the war, in my opinion. And I wondered if you had any knowledge of that or any perspective on how the technology helped us win the war.
Yeah, Paul Kennedy just came out with a really good book about certain engineers and their inventions and technology that, in his interpretation, did help win the war. Self-sealing fuel tanks is one really good example because, obviously, self-sealing fuel tanks is going to minimize engine fires and plane explosions and so on and so forth. So, you know, when you're talking about World War II airstrikes or air raids, you're going to take a lot of hits from flak, especially in the famous bombing campaigns in Europe. If you've got fuel tanks that are less vulnerable, you've got a nice advantage there. And that is an extremely important side of the Allied war effort, but specifically the American war effort is the technological know-how that leads to significant advantages that, you know, help lead to Allied victory in World War II.
Now, we're looking now, getting down to the last 5 minutes of the ball. Was this a great program, John. As usual, you're bringing all your knowledge to our listeners. It generated quite a few calls. And by the way, folks, keep them coming. We still have a few minutes, 877-573-7825. Is there something that you can tie in, John, between all three of these guys? First, they were all West Point. That we know. Here's to the point. Okay. So tie them all in. What about these interactions?
Eisenhower is the key personality in that he has a deep relationship with both of them, with MacArthur and with Bradley. In MacArthur's case, it's as an uncomfortable subordinate, but one of unusual influence and a rival, ultimately. In Bradley's case, it's as a friend in the same class at West Point and from very similar backgrounds. Bradley was a small-town guy from mid-Missouri for whom the Army represented a great deal of opportunity, just like Eisenhower, and they had a great rapport on that level and a great friendship and a tremendous respect for each other. So Eisenhower is sort of the key, is sort of the spoke in the wheel in that respect. But I also think these three personalities, you could argue, have more or the most influence on the 20th century U.S. Army than anybody. And certainly they're involved in momentous events and campaigns that we still remember all these decades later.
Well, folks, we're getting down to the end of the program, and I do want to give us a scoop today with John McManus. If, by the way, If you're looking for the books, you want to go to VeteransRadioBookstore.com. That's right, Veterans Radio Books. Because every time that you purchase something from Amazon, yeah, we get a little bit, but you know what helps? It keeps us on the air. And two of them that we're going to be putting, and by the way, Jim Fossil, we will have that book on our bookstore. That's VeteransRadioBookstore.com. VeteransRadio.com. And our website is getting a whole new look. Oh, wait till you see it. I'm so excited about that. But before we do that, here is the scoop right now, and I know I can say this. Author John McManus, coming out in May, first week, in time for the 70th anniversary of D-Day, The Dead and Those About to Die. Tell us about that, John.
Right. The book is called The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the Big Red on Omaha Beach. And this is the entire story of the 1st Infantry Division on D-Day at Omaha Beach, and it tells you a lot of why things turned out the way they did. Believe it or not, there really hasn't been much done on this aspect of the invasion at Omaha Beach. And so the book will tell you sort of from the, the private's point of view to the general's point of view exactly how this plays out, answer a lot of questions, and I think it's really one of the last D-Day stories that hasn't been kind of done to death by historians, that you'll see the invasion in a new way and hopefully learn some new things about it. So it'll be out on May 6th, and as you can tell, I'm pretty excited about it.
Can you buy it now at all?
You can pre-order it right now at Amazon.com, either in hardcover or if you prefer electronic copies, you can even pre-order an electronic copy to where the day the book is released, it'll automatically be sent to you.
Well, I was a member of the Big Red One as well as the 101st Airborne Division. Oh boy, I got them both ways. I mean, that was a nice military experience for me. Getting back though to Omaha Beach, they almost pulled off the beach, pulled the forces, moved them down a little bit. But I thought, myself, again, my opinion, what it really was you're not going to defeat the American Army. Why? Because we improvise. We were taught to improvise when things are going down. You go and you change direction. You don't have to necessarily get an order from a general or what. Where the Germans were waiting for orders, and there were the Americans. They improvised. They got through the minefields. They got up to the P.O. boxes. Tell us about that, John.
The real strength of the U.S. Army, and what I would say in the case of the Big Red One, they have a kind of a military version of muscle memory. Many of these guys have been in combat before or have had so much training that they kind of know how to react under these adverse circumstances, or at least enough of them do. And, you know, as you say, many of them are going to be landed in horrible spots where they'll just be decimated by German firepower, but the survivors will improvise and get around. You'll see them get around what are called the draws, which are the key beach exits, and start to move in over the heavier terrain and try and flank around the Germans. I mean, it's just the kind of thing you're going to do to survive. But they'd also been taught to do that. So it's really quite remarkable. You're going to see, and I really talk about this in the book, several key personalities, fascinating people, who have a very profound effect on the outcome of the Battle of Omaha Beach. And I've been able to delve into that, and I think in a way that's never really been quite done before, with a lot of new information about that.
Well, here we go. Last minute, we want to thank... Oh, and by the way, another book that I have in front of me, September Hope. I wanted to talk with John about it. We'll have to wait for another program, but September Hope, The American Side of a Bridge Too Far, John C. McManus. He's also the author of Grunt's many other books. He's with Caliber Press. John, I want to thank you very much for being on the program. Would you come back again?
I would love to come back again. Thanks for having me. It's a great time.
Well, thank you very much. Whew. And oh, there's our theme. There it is. And don't forget, folks, if you can, send a little good luck to Dale. Dale at VeteransRadio.net. Dale at VeteransRadio.net. This is Bob Gould, Nina Golding Diaz, Dale Throneberry, and all of us here at WDEO. You are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.